Psykiatrikerna.
Hej och välkomna till avsnitt 2 av våran poddserie The Psychiatrist. Och idag ska vi, det är jag, Anders Hansen och min kollega
Simon Kraga.
Vi ska idag lyssna på en intervju som vi gjorde med Moshe Tsyf, som är en farmakolog utbildad vid Harvard och idag verksam vid McGill som ligger i Montreal.
Och han är väl egentligen den som är mest känd för att ha gjort epigenetik på beteende.
Precis. Och epigenetik då, för den som behöver uppdatera vad det är för någonting, så är det då en slags koppling mellan arv och miljö. Närmare bestämt hur uttrycket, expressionen av våra gener påverkas av miljön. Och då vet vi sedan tidigare att det finns många olika faktorer, miljögifter och vad vi är med om vi till exempel rör på oss, är fysiskt aktiva, allt det påverkar uttrycket av våra gener. Det påverkar inte generna i sig, men hur de används. Och Moshe Tsyf är en portalfigur inom epigenetiken som har visat att det vi är med om i form av erfarenheter, till och med det våra mödrar är med om, kan påverka genexpressionen hos kommande generationer. Det finns forskning som har gjorts på möss där man visar att möss som lyfts bort från sin mamma när de är nyfödda en timme per dag, de kommer ha en helt annan stresskänslighet senare i livet. Om de här mössen utsätts för ett kraftigt ljud så reagerar de mycket kraftfullare på det. Det här är klassiska ångest- och stressbeteenden som djuren uppvisar, som beror på att de har lyfts bort, eller tros beror på att de har lyfts bort från sin mamma. Samma sak har man kunnat visa, att till och med om mamman stressas under graviditeten så påverkas avkomman av det i vuxen ålder, i form av ökad stresskänslighet. Den här epigenetiska forskningen är av ganska enkelt insedda skäl väldigt kontroversiell, eftersom den har visat att upplevelser i barndomen och till och med innan man föds kan påverka stresskänslighet och ångestbenägenhet senare i livet. Och det är naturligtvis fynd som kan vara potentiellt skuldbeläggande för människor.
Så vi har ju på något sätt gått varvet runt här, från psykoanalytens betoning av modern tillbaka nu med betoning på modern ur ett epigenetiskt perspektiv. Men vi fick i alla fall möjligheten att träffa Moshe Tsyf i Toronto i den här gigantiska konferenshuset som ligger mitt inne i stan.
Och ljudet störs lite grann av att det brusar i bakgrunden av en fläkt.
However, what we learned recently is that in addition to that developmental programming of genes, experience can program genes. And what's unique about those programs that are epigenetics is that they're stable for a long time. So even though the experience was very short, the programming will be very long. So if you experience the very heavy load of stress, that can change the way genes work in many, many tissues, and particularly in the brain, and change your phenotype. We believe that these changes are actually adaptive, so they prepare you for the kind of world that the stress is signaling. So if a child is born in a world where there's no food, it prepares them to want to eat a lot of food when they have access to it. So binging becomes an adaptive trait. But binging in a society where food is abundant is maladaptive. So essentially, epigenetic programming that on the basis of it are adaptive, they are programming organisms to fit to the world, can become maladaptive and cause disease, including mental health disease.
So in a sense, it's an evolutionary adaptive sort of response, but that has become sort of unsynced to some extent with today's society.
It's most of the time it's synced, but and that's why we are such so resilient. So I think even humans have probably the most sophisticated ability to do that. But we are changing society even faster than such a very sophisticated mechanism. So the main difference that happens in our society is that classic evolutionary signals don't signal the same things anymore. So for example, lack of food during childhood doesn't necessarily mean that you won't have access to high calories later in life. And that has to do with the fact that calories are cheap, especially in the Western world. So you can be programmed now to deal with low calories, but you're actually going to be exposed to high calories. And you can see it very nicely if you look in Bangladesh. Poor people are never obese, right? They're actually very fit to deal with the world they're going to live in, because they're born in poverty, they will die in poverty, and that adaptation is very useful. In the United States, you see a lot of obesity in poor people, and that's probably true for Western Europe, because poor people get this evolutionary signal, life is tough, you know, better eat whenever you have food, but then calories are quite cheap. And so these signals are disjointed. So classical evolutionary signals become now disjointed and distorted by the rapid pace of human development.
But it's basically a way for nature to tailor us to the world.
Right.
To that.
Right. And the nature has used the early life as the best time to do it, right? Because
and what is early life exactly?
Early life is from probably preconception to the first years of childhood.
Okay.
And at different times in this scheme of events, you learn different things, right? Food could probably be a signal that happens already in the womb. You don't need a social world to recognize that, whereas certain social cues can only happen later in life. Perhaps sexual cues only happen during puberty, right? So, for example, the effect of a balance of males and females can change your sexual behavior, right? So if there's very few males and many females, the females should be aggressive to get a male, and the males don't need to be aggressive, and vice versa. So at different points in life, we get those signals as systems develop, and I think different systems program themselves at different times.
But in terms of stress, what would be the most critical period?
It seems that stress is definitely maternal pregnancy and definitely the first years of life, because what we saw with the maternal care model, they're fostered, so it wasn't pregnancy. They were not stressed in pregnancy. Mm. It's after birth.
Okay.
So the first year that the mother takes care of her children is very critical for shaping, you know, the phenotype.
Okay.
So, I mean, from a clinical perspective, I guess with the high amount of mothers who develop depression and anxiety postpartum, this is really important then to, as soon as possible,
to intervene,
get treatment, and then
right.
and then to
exactly. I mean, the challenge, however, is to focus on the vulnerable and to avoid the resilient, right?
Yeah.
Because you know the treatment effect is much larger if you focus it on the right people, and you know. So the challenge, I think, of modern psychiatry will be get really good markers that you know. Give you who are the high-risk people, high-risk kids, and then focus intervention on them, and you'll see a very strong effect. Of course, if you treat the whole population, many of which are resilient anyways, the effect will be very small, and the cost will be very large, and it will become unfeasible, right?
Yeah.
And so I think that's the great challenge, to identify those people, because not everybody tells you that they were stressed during pregnancy, and as you saw, appraisal is really important, so it's not just whether they were stressed and how they appraise that stress. The question, can we get markers better than what we have today, which is just the talking and the observational and questionnaires to identify those peoples that need really to be worked on? You know, if we start treating mental health as health rather than as something that has to do with higher, you know, human identities, you know, the brain is the machinery through which we execute our identity, but still the machinery. And as long as you understand it as a machinery, there's no difference between this and protecting yourself from diabetes, right? If you know as a kid that you can get diabetes, and if you change your diet, you know, you can protect yourself. That's important. But those interventions are tough, and you don't want to do them on everybody. There's no way. There's no reason.
But so we're talking here about like a selection pressure on almost like an evolutionary.
Right. There is natural selection for sure. You know, when you have a bottleneck of so few people.
Right.
Yeah.
But then is also IQ, could IQ be epigenetically?
Right. So that's a big thing. You know, IQ was considered totally genetic for a long time.
Right.
But people questioned that research. Mm-hmm. You know, was it driven by just class or racism, or you know, a lot of it was racially driven, especially against Asians and Africans and things like that. The last guy who said that was Watson, right? And he got into serious trouble for saying that IQ is genetic. And so,
although heritability estimates still
of course,
argue
there is,
around
it. There's no doubt there's a... The question is, you know, the question is not whether you have those genes, is what you can do about it to change it, right?
Exactly.
That's why I said, I'm not interested in documenting, you know, human misery. Mm-hmm. Can we take people with genes that, let's say, now are in IQ of 100 and bring them to 130, right? So can we go above the genes by an epigenetic intervention? Mm. And I think that's the challenge, right? How do we take people who and there are animal experiments that suggest that even mice that are genetically stupid because they have a mutation, a knockout in a gene that is important for learning, mm-hmm. could become like normal animals if their mother was enriched. So, and so there are few genes that we know are involved in cognition and learning, and we can mutate them and we can override that. So this is the interesting message. Not that genetics is important. Of course it is important. The question is, can you override it? And that's what you want to do as a psychiatrist, right?
Right.
Yeah. You know that there are certain bad things that happen and perhaps bad genes, but what do you do about it? Right,
and but so in that sense, it's a way to regaining control and stepping back from genetic determinants.
Right, yeah. Right. Genetic is there, you know. It is there, and the question is, what do you do about it as a psychiatrist? Do you just say, "Oh, too bad, you have a bad gene," you know, next patient, or you say, "Oh, you have a bad gene, but we can do something about this, and we'll make your gene look good." And so, but what epigenetics can do is change levels of gene expression. See, what genetics does is change levels of gene expression, right? Except, you know, so there are two kinds of genetic mutations. There are those that are, you know, a missense or nonsense mutation. They change the amino acid structure, right? These changes change a protein, right? And it's very hard to fix. The others are regulatory changes. They just increase the expression by a little reduce. With epigenetics, you can change expression, you know, a thousandfold. So theoretically, you should be able to manipulate even bad genes to express like good genes.
Mm. How has interest in the field developed?
Oh, huge.
The
you know,
last years?
If you look at the PubMed papers, you know, in behavioral epigenetics from 2004 with zero, you know, it goes exponentially. And the same is for other fields of medicine, you know, diabetes, cardiovascular is now becoming big, exercise, nutrition. It provides a uniform kind of way of looking at human disease, you know. So now it doesn't make a difference if you're a psychiatrist, nutritionist, you know, you're talking about the same language and trying to... So everybody is interested now in early life, and everybody is interested, whether you're a psychologist, a cardiovascular, a...
So you're sort of envisioning a new role for a psychiatrist within the epigenetic framework.
I think that
focus less on the brain and more on the whole sort of system.
I think you'll have to do that. Mm-hmm. And I think you'll get a lot, you gain a lot in treating your patients by doing that. First, know a lot about the patient, not just his brain, which some psychiatrists don't know. So much so that sometimes I ask psychiatrists, you know, how many cancer cases do you have? And they don't know.
Because you're actually using cancer medication to
alter exactly.
the epigenetic expression.
Right. So you would expect that some people... So it's very interesting. So when I first discovered that valproic acid causes DNA demethylation, there was an old pharmacologist in our department said, it's impossible because so many people are treated with valproic acid and they must have cancer and it must have worked for them, you know? And indeed, there is epidemiology, you know? So one way is just to go at people who are treated with a certain medication and see what happened to their mental health. You know, so you can know if certain cancer, you know, medications are actually improving mental health just by going to the charts of people
going
who are treated.
Backwards, yes,
And we rarely do that. We rarely do that. And we know very little about comorbidities that are outside our immediate disciplines, right? Yeah. So a psychiatrist will know about comorbidity, you know, between depression and suicidal ideation and PTSD, and they will know that. But they will not know if that person had breast cancer, you know?
No.
And or will get breast cancer after she saw you.
Would it also be relevant to talk about relatives and the risk for them to have breast cancer? And
I think everything is. I think is the future of psychiatry is that those people who will make those links, who will be knowledgeable and talented enough, you know, not to be stuck just to psychiatry, but look at the other things that is happening to their patients.
To actually have a broader perspective. Yeah,
and they'll start finding things that they never thought about.
Vad tycker du om det där, Simon?
Jag tycker personligen att det är otroligt intressant, för att det var så olika aspekter i det han sa som verkligen kan få stor betydelse både för psykiatri men kanske också för hur vi ser på människan och människans beteende i stort.
Ja, verkligen. En studie som han har publicerat som han inte pratade om här är en undersökning som gjordes efter den här isstormen i Quebec som faktiskt blev en film.
Ja, precis. För att han tar ju upp det här med att det är svårt med epigenetisk forskning, eftersom om man bara befinner sig i en situation och tolkar att den situationen då leder till den här epigenetiska förändringen, då skulle man i princip också kunna säga att det likadant skulle kunna vara genetik. Så att det han gör är ju då att lite tillsammans med kollegor titta på, ska vi säga, miljöhändelser, alltså väldigt allvarliga naturkatastrofer, och undersöker över tid hur det här har fluktuerat för att sedan avgöra ifall det faktiskt påverkar epigenetiken.
Precis. Och den här studien som bygger på den här isstormen 1998, den handlar då om att under den här stormen som slog ut stora delar av Quebec och elektriciteten, så blev det kallt där, ner mot 30 grader minus. Och då var människor tvungna att antingen flytta till släktingar eller bo i härbergen under en tid innan elen kom tillbaka. Och då fanns det kvinnor i det här området som var gravida under den här perioden. Och det var naturligtvis stressande för dem att inte ha någonstans att ta vägen. Och det Tsyfans kollegor har gjort är att följa barnen som föddes efter de här graviditeterna. Och till och med tittat på dem i tonåren. Och sett epigenetiska förändringar hos dem. Och exakt vad det får för konsekvenser, det är för tidigt att säga, men det är ganska omfattande förändringar. Och de verkar dessutom vara gradberoende, där de kvinnor som har upplevt extra stor stress, som till exempel inte hade släktingar bo hos utan som var tvungna att flytta in på den här bergen, deras barn uppvisar större förändringar. Så.
Ja, och det intressanta som jag kände att jag gärna hade pratat mera med honom om var ju det faktum också att i den studien så fanns det ju en korrelation till den objektiva stressen, men däremot inte den subjektivt upplevda stressen.
Exakt.
Det var en skillnad där, vilket jag tyckte var oerhört intressant.
Mm. Och därmed tackar jag Anders Hansen
och Simon Kjaga
för att ni har lyssnat på det här poddavsnittet. Nästa avsnitt blir det ännu en internationell storhet, Carl Dieseroth, som är Mr. Optogenetik och som dessutom har grundlagt inte bara ett utan två glödheta forskningsområden.
Den här podcasten har möjliggjorts genom Otsuka och Lundbeck. People creating products for better health worldwide with progress in mind.